Let's dive right in. Last time we finished up with top-down parsing and established how the LLK parser actually works, and have started a different approach to parsing, particularly the bottom-up parsing in the form of shift-reduced parsers. So what are shift-reduced parsers about? The general idea is to fill the pushdown of your automaton with symbols from the terminals and non-terminals. And the terminals you would get by shifting them away from the input onto the pushdown. The non-terminals you would get by an operation that we call reduce or reduction. The reduction is performed by replacing the right-hand side of a rule that you detected to be lying on top of the stack with the left-hand side of that particular production, thus reducing the size of the pushdown and conceptually kind of moving up in in the parse tree that you have found so far. So that is the kind of general concept. What we also discovered last time is that although that in principle is a way to parse input, the problem in that approach is that you still need some way of telling whether you should continue shifting additional terminals from the input onto your pushdown, or whether now would be a good time to take the right-hand side that you see that's lying around on your pushdown and reduce it to a new non-terminal. So far, that has been a non-deterministic decision, and now we're after ideas of how to give us guidance in the decision whether to shift or to reduce. And that's what this concept of LR parsing is all about. So, good way to begin. So, LR parsing it is now. In order to do so, let's have a look at how a run of our shift-reduced parser on a specific example input actually looks like. Maybe we can get a few ideas of how to improve our algorithm from that. So for that, I have created an example input that looks like that. And the grammar is the usual one with the E's and the T's and the F's and encoding the arithmetic expressions. So as we don't have to do, or as you don't have to do the decisions whether to reduce or whatever to do yourself, you can just watch that thing. We will already see what the actual parse bound looks like, parse tree looks like on the right hand side here, and let's just try to observe what happens in terms of configurations of that example computation and how that corresponds to state of the parse tree that we have assembled so far, and vice versa, maybe the rightmost derivation of that tree. So, for a successful parsing run of that shift-reduced parser, what would happen is it would first have to shift the actual name onto the pushdown. Then what happens is that one gets reduced to F, So you see, there's something missing from the input. We have replaced already the first thing over here, and also we have marked the part of the parse tree that we have constructed so far. Yeah, we would continue by reducing this F even more to T, which would kind of increase the first subtree by 1, so that we have reached that level already. What would happen then is we would shift another symbol from the input, so star goes down there. We would also move the 2 onto there, which would be a token of type int. We would then replace it with F, which would kind of stop the kind of reduction process of that subtree and open up another subtree, like this one here, that now stops at F. The other one stops at T. That's also, you can also see that in the pushdown itself. Then we find that this thing is the right-hand side of another production, which corresponds in like assembling those two subtrees that we so far have treated as different subtrees into one. So we join them in one, which would lead us to abstract it with just a T. Then we would continue by replacing that with E, so far reaching this part over here, and so on. So we would shift another thing, and so on. Yeah. So you see, these are step-by-step growing, these parse trees, while the pushdown itself is, in the end, empty. That's how the whole thing looked like. Now let's look at two particular steps in these computations. There was one where we performed a reduction, a very specific reduction, where we did replace the T times F with a T. So on the pushdown, it looked like it's just T times F on there. In terms of the part of the deduction tree that we of the parse tree that we uncovered so far, it's just two separate trees. And in our case, we would choose by some based on something that we don't know yet to replace it with T. Contrary to that, we also have another situation where we have F as the top of the stack. That's the same as we have here. But now we choose to do different thing. We would reduce to T in that case. So the question is now, how do we know which of those two things we're going to choose for reduction? Do we either try to grab the whole right-hand side, T times F, or do we just grab the F and reduce? And the thing that you already maybe have seen flashing up there is that one thing that you can use for deciding that is kind of the pushdown content over here. That is somehow reflecting the past decisions that you already have done in terms of, well, that is containing the part that has already been joined up into parts of your parse tree, and that is kind of the history that you've done. And in context of certain historical decisions, it only makes sense to do particular things. For example, in this E plus F situation here, the way to go with your input would be that it can only be combined into a complete parse tree if you go like this, where you have your root over here. You would take your already collapsed subtree here as given, You see that plus is already lying here, and if you then find an f over here, it would make sense to go on by reducing f to t in order to complete this subtree over here into a tree that conforms to our grammar. While as over here, the sensible thing would be to say, well, here we know that there's no further left context to this one that corresponds somehow to for example, the e plus prefix or something. So in that sense, it would be more sensible to choose this thing here in order and reduce it into a t. So the idea would be to take the content of the pushdown as your first hint for what you should actually do. So that the decisions that you take for reducing or shifting or actually reducing with whatever alternative you have are making sense in the context of the decisions that you have done in the past already. Though we would assume that a certain decision makes sense if there are actually productions that start from your root symbol that can by steps of well maybe that's the wrong direction to take it from. So starting from a certain computational state where you have a remaining input, some content on the pushdown already lying there, and some right-hand side of production. It makes sense to reduce with a certain production to some other configuration over here if you can continue to do reductions and at some point will reach the start symbol with the empty input. So that is kind of the formalization of the idea that you would want to do reductions only then if at some point they will lead to a successful parse tree. And yeah, that is the way to go here. If there is such a production that enables you to reach the final configuration of your final successful configuration of your automaton, then you would call the part on the push down with which you started, which is some kind of content that was historically placed there, and your right-hand side of a production as a viable prefix for the complete item that has this gamma thing as its right-hand side and this B as its left-hand side. So, yeah, this viable prefix is kind of an indicator for for reducing with the rule that is meant with this complete item. So that is kind of only describing the situation that we have when we do when we do a meaningful reduction over here. Our goal is to kind of get a guidance on how to actually act. So for that, instead of looking for viable prefixes, that is, well, the more generic definition of that, is instead to determine all the rules that are somehow matching for the current content of the pushdown, so that we get an overview of the sensible decisions that we can take. And if we only see that there's only one sensible action to take there left, then we would probably take that. So our idea would be to come up with a way of computing the admissible items for a certain content of the pushdown. What does that mean? Well, an item is admissible for a certain string of non-terminals and terminals, alpha prime. So that is this one over here. That that one is consisting of two parts, alpha and gamma, while alpha, you see, is the so far already reduced or collapsed subtrees of our parse procedure, and gamma is the current top of our pushdown. And we call an item, B goes to that particular gamma, dot beta as admissible, if it's actually possible to reach this configuration alpha B with some yield that doesn't interest us so much. That's actually reachable via rightmost derivations with the alpha from our pushdown. Okay, so for computing that, there is a certain observation, and that is to do with, well, if you kind of look at a lot of these pushdown contents that you can observe during the run of such a shift reduced parser, if you happen to have a lot of insight into that, you might see that it could be possible to describe those pushdown contents that are appropriate for a reduction with a certain production via a regular language. So it would be kind of describable via regular expression. And that is the key observation here. It turns out that for LR parsing, you can describe all the situations in which you would reduce based on a certain pushdown content with a regular expression or a finite automaton. So the idea would be now to guide the shift reduce parser in its decision whether to reduce with rule A or rule B, or whether to even shift, by analyzing the pushdown of each computational step with the help of another automaton, a finite automaton that kind of piggybacks the other one. And if that automaton discovers that the content of the pushdown is one that matches a pattern that is suited for reduction, then we would actually reduce. And if the automaton would say, no, it's not a good idea to reduce that, and we would shift. So that is what we are after, and it turns out that you can actually construct such a thing by just transforming the productions of your grammar into appropriate transitions of such an automaton. How would that work in practice? We would create an automaton that is working on states that we consider to be items. The start state is once again this artificial thing that we always introduce with S prime goes to bullet S. The final states are the ones that should guide us to do actual reductions. So the final states are productions from our grammar that have the marker on the very right hand side. So these are complete items. And what are the transitions in this characteristic automaton? You have transitions that go from one item to another with reading a particular non-terminal. If the source item had its marker in front of that particular non-terminal, and the target item has its marker at the end of a certain, directly after that non-terminal. So it kind of just moved the bullet by one symbol so that it got here. The other type of transitions would be the ones that would connect an item that has its marker in front of a non-terminal and would just connect it with the item that has its marker on the very left-hand side, and on the left-hand side of the production would have the same non-terminal that the marker has been before. That automaton is called the characteristic automaton. From just the formal definition of that, it's maybe a little bit hard to see what the thing is actually about, so let's have a look at a more graphical version of that. That is what you see here is the grammar that we are working on. That's still the usual arithmetic expressions grammar. Now, the characteristic automaton, how does it look like? There's two kinds of transitions in there. There's the ones that do actually read something from the pushdown of the shift-reduce parser. That is the ones that you have in there. And they roughly correspond if you see them in the sequence, they roughly correspond to detecting a right-hand side of a production of the grammar. So, for example, this one here, it just reads E, and that is, well, okay. There's also this one in there that I still haven't considered as one that I have to add to the grammar, but so it's probably a bad example. So let's consider this one over here. This one just reads a T. This one corresponds to this right-hand side of a production. You can also look at this sequence over here. This reads E plus T, which corresponds to that right-hand side. And they are, it's pretty clear that they do that because, well, they are based on shifting the bullet from one symbol even further until it reaches the end. So that's why they represent the right-hand sides. So that is so far not very surprising. The expressional power of this automaton comes from the second type of transition that is used to create the characteristic automaton that I haven't put in this diagram so far. That is the epsilon transitions. Remember, we had this second line of transitions that are in there, and those required to create transitions between items in the situation that the bullet in one of the items is directly in front of some non-terminal, like it is, for example, for this one over here. Here, the bullet is directly in front of the E, and our transitions, what did they say? Well, I have to connect this item with an epsilon transition to all the items that have that particular non-terminal symbol as left-hand side. So I have to connect this item here to all the items that have E as their left-hand side, which is this and this. So we would connect them like this with epsilon transitions. Here, there's nothing to do. For that one, for example, we would have to connect to itself once again with an epsilon transition, but also to this one over here, because there's the bullet in front of the E, and so on. The ones these are the ones that look a little bit not so exciting at the first point. It's more exciting to have this one, for example. That one connects to the T things, like this one and this one over here. And what do these epsilon transitions actually add? Well, they help in the getting the context of certain right-hand sides of productions right, in the sense that, for example, if your stack content would be something like E plus F, for example, what you would actually have to do is, well, you would go non-deterministically at first to this. Well, you would start with this one here, of course, because that's the root production. Then you would non-deterministically go over here, because I just say so, that it is non-deterministically working like that. Then we would consume the E. That would lead us over here. Then we would consume the plus, which would lead us over here. And then, at that point, this E plus F never has been something that you could find as right-hand sides over here so far. That is something that is composed from several productions, and depending on what you have reconstructed so far as your candidate for a parse tree, the E plus whatever would actually have to be finished with a T, but we don't find that in our actual input. Instead, we find an F, and that is what is represented with this epsilon transitions over here. These connect so far not finished right-hand sides with kind of the expansions that they can do. For example, with this T, this could go over here, where you can actually consume an F now. So we do that and reach this thing over here. And if the pushdown now has reached its top, we see that our automaton has reached that particular item over here, which is a complete item. And remember, complete items for us are final states. Final states we associated with situations where we have to actually perform a reduce. And we can even decide with what to reduce by looking into the state and reading the item there. It says T goes to F. That is the completed item in there. So I have to reduce with T goes to F. So that would tell us to take away the F and replace it with a T. That is a valid step in our shift reduce parser and has created a new pushdown content. And with that, I have to restart scanning my pushdown for what I should do next. So I would reset everything in there and rescan in pursuit of what I should actually do. And this time, well, since I don't have an F anymore, I will probably read a T now, which will make me reach this thing over here, and finally reduce everything to E, and in the end, everything to S prime. So that is, in principle, the idea of what's happening there. So this would be the completely connected automaton, where we have added all the transitions that have been specified in our formal specification before. And that is the automaton that completely suffices to scan the automaton for whatever action I should do depending on the history, what I've done before. That is this characteristic automaton. Since that is still an automaton that has the non-deterministic decisions in there, because they are still epsilon transitions, that is something that I probably might not want to have. So we can resort to the means that we have for making the whole thing deterministic, and that would be, for example, this power set construction that would create a thing like this one over here, and that would be now the automaton that we can directly use, because, well, there's no non-determinism in there anymore. A little bit similar to what we have seen for the Barisethi approach. We can also do a construction of the canonical automaton, or also the deterministic automaton, in a more direct way than first of all construct the non-deterministic automaton and then try to do the power set construction. We can do it straight away if we keep to a certain approach. So let's do that over here. So we would probably start with first state. That would always be a state that comprises S prime going to, our root element is this E thing with the bullet in the beginning. Okay, what else do we need to integrate into our first state in the deterministic automaton? Well, there have been these epsilon transitions that were always added to the non-deterministic automaton whenever we had the bullet in front of a non-terminal. So in order to kind of do these steps and integrate that into one state, what I can do is I can straight away add the items that are reached via these epsilon transitions into one state, and that's what I can do here. I will integrate this E goes to E plus T, as well as E goes to T in there. in order to make the epsilon transitions unnecessary. So far, that's quite nice. But now what I've done is, apart from adding another item that has the bullet in front of E, I have also added an item that has the bullet in front of a T. And once again, that is the criterion for epsilon transitions. So once again, I need to add further items to my initial state, namely the ones that are that are based on the production with T on the left-hand side. So these are this one over here. So we'll do T goes to T times F, as well as T goes to F. And once again, check for the epsilon transition. This one, principle would create any new epsilon transitions, but I already have added all my T productions in there. But now there's this F thing, so to add that one too. F goes to E, and F goes to int. So now I have to check once more. The bullet here is in front of a terminal, so that one can't be further expanded. Here the bullet is in front of another terminal, so once again that can't be expanded. So we're all in all done with the initial state. So that is kind of the power set construction already included into the automaton construction by just shoving all the items into a state in case that there would be an epsilon transition to that state. So that is the initial state. Now, how do I get my other states of the automaton? Well, I need to do transitions of my initial state with whatever can appear as from my alphabet. And since this automaton is one that is supposed to run on the pushdown of a shift reduce parser, we can, for example, have non-terminals as the as potential input for that thing. So let's take, for example, E as an input for my automaton. And if I go E from Q0, this will create a new state, probably, which will then have to figure out how what that is. So if I try to remember what kind of transitions we had, the ones that were consuming things were ones that were shifting the bullet around within an item, and they would do that if they if the bullet is in front of the consumed symbol. So in our case, in Q0, I have the bullet in front of E in that item here, in this one, in this one, and those are pretty much all. So those are the ones that I consider for this transition over here. So we'll say that Q1 will be S prime going to E, with a bullet over here. There's the one from here, as well as E goes to E bullet plus T. That is this one. Am I done yet? Well, also in this case, I have to check for whether there are possible epsilon transitions in the characteristic automaton. So I check the position of my bullet here. It is the last thing in my item, so there's nothing reachable via epsilon transitions from here. And here, the bullet is in front of a terminal symbol, so for that one also, nothing is connected with epsilon transitions, so I'm done with that state over here. Yeah, and so I will continue on. For example, I can have a look at what happens when I do a transition with plus from my Q1. I assume it will probably create another new state over here. And yeah, for that I have to choose the items in Q1 that have the marker bullet in front of the input of plus, and that will be only this one over here. So it's probably over quite soon. So let's include that in here. E will go to E plus bullet T. And now I realize, oh no, the bullet is once again in front of a non-terminal, so I have to go through all the things that are reachable through T, so I will also include T goes to T times F, T goes to bullet F, and yeah, I've done so in the Q0 case. There's a lot of other items that still need to be added. This F goes to brackets and F goes to int, for example. So, all in all, there will be several states that we can reach through that. And we only stop with generating these states when we have reached the state that we have reached so far before, and in those cases we would stop. So these are the ones that are all based on Q0. You can go E, T, F, and int from there, and I think also the opening bracket. So, yeah, that is this one over here. And then you see I've done the continuation with plus that created... Yeah, that was the last thing that we have seen me constructing by hand. That would have resulted in this one over here. But you see there's a lot of others that are also reachable from there. In fact, it's two screens of of my prepared slides that can be filled with those things until we have exhausted the state space of the thing. But with that, we have created all the 11 states that are reachable from the input and from the start. And if we compare it to the one that we have that we could obtain from doing the characteristic automaton and the power set construction afterwards, you see it has the same amount of states. So, yeah, instead of doing two constructions, we can do just one construction and be done with that. The formal way of doing that looks like this. All we need is actually one helper function, delta star, which is the so-called epsilon closure, and that is for performing these epsilon transitions in the case that we hit an item that has the bullet in front of some non-terminal symbol. So that's what you see defined over here. The epsilon closure of some state Q is everything that has been Q so far, together with in case that we find an item within Q that has the marker in front of a particular non-terminal symbol, what we do is we look at all the non-terminals that we can produce, starting from B star, as prefixes of right-hand sides. And for these, we add items that have the bullet on the left-hand side. That is what we have done in our construction so far. Every time we hit an item that had the bullet in front of some non-terminal, we added all the items that were constructed from this non-terminal with a bullet on the left side. So that is the epsilon closure. We can use that now to create a canonical LR0 automaton by considering states of our automaton as sets of items. The start state would emanate from the now well-known artificial production S prime goes to bullet S, and then perform the epsilon closure on that. Final states, we consider states that have completed items in there. So that is something that we kind of inherited from the power set construction of the characteristic automaton. It suffices that there is one completed item in there for the whole thing to become a final state. And the transitions we create are, well, a transition of a state under a certain symbol X is just moving the bullet in front of set X if we can find it in an item of my source state, one place to the right, and then we need to once again perform the epsilon closure. So if you do this algorithm yourself, the performing the epsilon closure after each of these steps is actually the most effort that you have to do in all that. That is the thing that is most easily forgotten by students, so it would be important to try to remember always to do the epsilon closure if you do another step in your canonical automaton. Okay, with that, you can try to set up a parser now that is that we would consider to be a so-called LR0 parser. A parser would try to manage viable prefixes on its pushdown, so it would not consider the things that are found on the pushdown as random garbage, but it would try to scan these things and look for reduction spots. And if it finds them, it would tell the shift reduce parser to actually perform the reduction. It can perform such a reduction then if such an item is considered admissible for alpha, and we can find out whether there is such an admissible item for the pushdown content by just inspecting the state that we can reach with the canonical automaton by scanning the viable prefix on the pushdown. So the general image is that of having the shift reduce parser working as kind of the large infrastructural automaton and having a small canonical automaton running on the pushdown of the shift reduce parser each time that there has been a step in the computation of the shift reduce parser. So it's kind of an automaton inception, so to say. You have an automaton within an automaton. So it kind of nicely combines two of the concepts of these theoretical computer science. For practical reasons, having kind of this little finite automaton running on the pushdown of a larger automaton again and again and again, that is something that is quite tedious. At first, it looks like you actually have to do this because you have to somehow interpret the content of the pushdown of the larger automaton. However, it turns out that in practice, it's especially when there's a lot of pushdown content, the part that is further down, the pushdown, won't change that quickly. So having to read that again and again and again is considered to be a thing that is probably quite redundant to do. So the question is there a way to actually get rid of that redundancy and not continually reread something that we already have read so far? And the idea, there is ideas there that do away with this redundancy. In particular, what you do is in actual LR0 parsers, you don't really put symbols of the input and the grammar anymore, but instead what you do is you kind of you keep the computation steps of the canonical automaton on there in the form of the trace of the states of the characteristic automaton. You can consider that as kind of a way of saving the computations that the canonical automaton has done so far. And in the case that the canonical automaton has reached a final state, all that is done is the part that is associated with detecting a right-hand side of production is removed from the computation, and instead what you do is you then continue with only one computational step from the state that you find on your pushdown that does a read of the left-hand side of the production that you have removed so far from the thing. That is kind of an approach that is similar to backtracking in your algorithm. So what you do is you kind of save the path that you have taken in your canonical automaton. In case that you have reached a final state, what you do is you backtrack until you have reached a state where you just unfolded a production that you have completed by reaching the endpoint, and instead of redescending into that part of the automaton, you treat the whole thing as if you would have just read the left-hand side of that production. That saves you rereading the complete beginning of the pushdown each time that you do a step, and instead what you do is you just put every step that your canonical automaton does onto your pushdown instead. Okay, well, that seems like quite an advanced approach already. However, there's still a hidden problem in there that stems from performing this power set construction, or this way of trying to get rid of the non-determinism from the characteristic automaton. In particular, what you get is that in our example, let's have an excerpt of the states that we have created. Let's focus, for example, on the state Q1. I think all the states that we have listed here are considered to be final states because they have complete items. However, if you look, for example, on in Q1, Q2, and Q9, you will notice, we have a final state because each of these things have a complete item. However, that is not the only item that our automaton says would be admissible for that input. There might also be for Q1, for example, this other item admissible. For Q2, this one. For Q9, this one. And they would, instead of reducing with a certain production, opt for performing a shift. So, although in certain cases, like the ones over here, where we have found suitable advice via our LR0 automaton, we still run into situations where we can't directly say what to do, whether to shift or to reduce. Although the situations are now not as many as they have been before, we have situations now for which we can decide. So, still, the whole thing is not deterministic yet, but patience, there will be ways of dealing with that later on. So, before we do that, how is the LR0 parser constructed? Well, for the LR0 parser itself has states from Q and a fresh symbol. It has a start state Q0 and a final state F. It has shift transitions that go from P by consuming A to PQ, with Q being the state that comes from the canonical automaton if you read the symbol A. There's reduce actions that are taken when are they taken? If a complete item is found in the state on top of the stack. And how does such a reduce action look like? Well, let's focus on the complete item that was found on the stack. It has M symbols on its right-hand side. So what will be done is we will remove the topmost M symbols from the pushdown and replace them, not the topmost M symbols, the topmost M states from the pushdown, and replace them with the state that we get by going from state P, that is the one that we find at the bottom of those M states, but this time by consuming A, which is the, let me highlight that in a different color, this A, which we find was the left-hand side of the complete item. And that is the state that we now put on top of the stack. So that is now the optimized version of not anymore the shift reduce parser, but that is now the LR0 parser. All it does is it manages states of the canonical automaton on its pushdown. Apart from that, it consumes input symbols. Yeah. All we then need is some kind of finishing transition. That is the one that we reach when the item that we find on top of the pushdown, which is then the kind of last state on there, if it contains our completed artificial start production, then we go into final state and be done with everything. So that is the LR0 parser for a certain grammar G. Yeah, if you want to show correctness, what you have to do is that you need to somehow relate the LR0 parser's computations to the ones of a shift reduce parser, which, well, since the those are subsets, you can find a kind of a correspondence for that. And from that, but once again, we won't go too much into details here because we already have a tight schedule. What we take away from that is that we will find that the accepted language of such a thing will be the one that belongs to the grammar, and what we get as an output of the thing is a sequence of reductions of an accepting computations that can be considered to be a reverse rightmost derivation based on our original grammar for that particular input. So we get a sequence of reductions that we can, for example, register callbacks for and then do some reactions to that particular derivation. So, yeah. However, we still have this problem of the LR0 parser only being deterministic in very few corner cases. We have seen situations for which the LR0 parser is non-deterministic already. These are quite prominent situations, so they have special names. They are called conflicts, and they are either reduce conflicts or shift reduce conflicts. So this one over here, a reduce conflict. This means that a final state of the canonical automaton has two complete items which are different from each other. So in that case, you the canonical automaton would not know whether to tell the LR0 parser to reduce with the first rule or with the second, because both of them are found in the state of the canonical automaton. For the shift-reduce conflict, we run into a state which is also considered a final state because it has a complete item in there for one rule. However, it also has a non-complete item over there that has the marker in front of a terminal, and those two are also said to be in conflict, particularly in shift-reduce conflict, with the reduced partner being the complete item and the shifting partner the one that is not completed. If we encounter such states in when we try to construct the LR0 canonical automaton for a grammar, we would consider the grammar to be LR0 unsuited. Well, what can we do to improve that? Well, let's revisit the conflicts of an LR0 automaton. For example, this one over here. There is the conflict of T being either reduced to E, which would correspond to this production here, E goes to T, or T being part of the right-hand side of another production in that form over here, for example. In that case, what we would have to do is we would have to shift. So the question is now, how can we actually determine which of those two things, whether we should do a reduction or whether we should perform shift operation here. The history of things that we have done so far obviously doesn't help the canonical automaton per se couldn't really help us in that case. So the question is, what is something that can actually help us in deciding what to do here? Yeah, that is another situation where we also have a T, but in that situation we would choose that the T belongs to a direct reduction and not to a shift reduction. And the question is now, with these two situations where here we obviously have to decide that T belongs to another T and needs to be part of a complete right-hand side here, and here T needs to be isolated, what can we use as foundations for deciding that? If it is not the pushdown content, well, is there a lot that's still remaining for us to get guidance from? Well, there's not. The only thing that we can use for guidance is now just, well, all that is remaining is the input. So, as we have also done for the LL parser, we can have a look ahead into the remaining input. Once again, with a limited size, but we could do that. Let's see whether that actually helps. So, back to the case here, where we decided that we would the thing to do here would have to be to shift. In that situation, for example, we had in the input the multiplication operator. So, what does that help us? Well, we can have a look at the spots within the grammar in which we actually can locate such a T and have a look how the right context of that spot looks like, whether we can, for example, find some terminal symbol that would tell us whether that spot in the grammar is the right one or some other. And in our case, where we have a multiplication operator remaining in the input, we would, for example, see that, oh, here, the only spot where the multiplication operator is actually occurring in the grammar is this one over here. So if the multiplication operator is the next in the input, and we have a T on the top of the pushdown, the only reasonable thing to do here in order to somehow do something that is matching our rules would be not to reduce, but instead to shift. So if the look ahead when top of pushdown is a T is a multiplication operator, we could try to incorporate that into our automaton in order to decide that. Maybe let's double check whether in our other situation where we would reduce the T to an E, whether there would be some evidence against that procedure. So let's have a look at that one once again. The T would in this case have to be reduced to an E. So let's check how the look ahead of the input actually looks like. So in that text we see the look ahead in the input would be a plus symbol. So what is the where does the plus symbol actually occur in our rule set? Well, that is the only place where we can find such a plus, but surprisingly, well, it's not a T that is to the left of that operator, but instead it's an E. How does that bode? Well, that's still something that we can work with, because, well, in our case, what we need to do is to reduce anyway. So T would be considered to be in the light of a reduction. It would already be the last symbol of a right-hand side anyway. And in our case, for this one over here, that is the case. T is the last symbol. And in order to reduce, what we must be interested in is, of course, if we consider the look ahead, it would be the right context of that, but that cannot be determined by looking at just that particular right-hand side anymore, because, well, it has already ended. We are already at the end of such a thing. So instead, we have to look at the right context of all the places where the production that the symbol on which right-hand side we actually are right now can occur. So where can E occur? E can occur here and here, and it has two possible right contexts. One would be the plus and one would be the closing bracket. And well, since we have found in the input already that the plus is the next thing that occurs there, this is the most likely context where plus is following the symbol T. So what we need to do is actually we need to perform a reduction to E such that we can somehow reach a situation where the right context is such a plus. So the other case in which we somehow needed to decide what to do with the T on top of the stack also worked out quite fine with our method. So maybe look ahead is the way to go. So that's the way we go. We consider K look ahead in conflict situations. That, of course, is something that you need a grammar, once again, that is suited for that. And for that, you need a context-free grammar, for which, if you have a sentence form alpha beta, that can be derived via several right derivation steps from a root symbol S. And if that is continued with the with the input terminals W and X, then a grammar is called an LRK grammar. If under the assumption that the first K symbols of W and X are the same, then it also needs to be that the production that you need to choose in order to create this alpha beta is the same. So there's no ambiguities in there. That is something that you need, because in the LRK parsers, what you actually do is you kind of do the reverse steps from the sentence form alpha beta to its alpha A, that somehow corresponds to a production of your grammar. So only if these reduction steps can be decided in a unique way, then the grammar is considered an LRK grammar, considering the first K symbols of the remaining input. So from that we can derive a kind of a strategy for testing grammars for whether they are actually LRK grammars. And what you have to do for that is you have to kind of iterate through all the rightmost derivations that are possible for your grammar. And in particular, all the intermediate steps of these rightmost derivations, and identify identify handles. These are the ones that are underlined with red in the sentence forms alpha, beta, omega, and with that you need to determine the minimal look ahead, such that you can associate the handle with a unique production for non-prefixing sentence forms. So maybe let's have a look at that in an example to illustrate what I want to say here. So first example would be that grammar over here. It's it has these three productions with alternations in there, and right away what we can see is that is, if we were going to do that with an LLK parsing algorithm, we would probably fail, because we would need to decide whether to go for A or B in the first expansion step, and A and B have the same first symbols, and then right away once again expand themselves, so they whatever look ahead window you assume that for that LL parser here, you would never be able to actually determine whether to expand to A or to B first. So that is an example for a grammar that is actually not LL for any K. However, let's have a look at how the right derivations of these things look like. So what can be right derivations of these? Well, if we do a right derivation just from the start, what would be a sentence form? For example, I could choose to start, well, always have to start with S, but the first derivation that I could do is, for example, create A. So that is something that I can produce by starting from S with a right derivation, and it confirms to that form somehow, at least. Well, the W is probably just the empty string, and alpha is also the empty string, and then there's only A left, and we can consider A to be the right hand side of that S without considering any input that comes to the right. So for that sentence form A, we don't need any look ahead here. So what else can be right derived from S? Well, it can also be B, for example, and that's kind of the similar case as we had for A, so that's not so much interesting. Then what else can I derive? If I go several steps, for example, I can from A derive an A B, for example. Yeah, and that I can also try to match in that form here, for example. And yeah, I have to once again consider that the W is just the empty string here. Alpha is also empty string in that case, and yeah, that would be a complete right-hand side, and that is not having any, that's not different from, for example, that would be another right derivation that I can do from that. In here, I would consider the B to be the W, AB to be the handle, and A to be the alpha over here. And yeah, I don't have any danger not enough coffee. Was ist verwechseln auf Englisch? Oh, thank you. That's depressing. Yeah, so I'm not in any danger of mixing up those two, because the alpha beta of those two parts is prefix free. We have this A part that differentiates this sentence from the one before, so there's no danger in mixing those two up. So in general, what we can generate as sentence forms with right derivations are the ones that we see here. You see the W's being optimized away from that, because if we look at all of those, they are they don't the prefixes of those things are actually different, so we cannot there's no case in which we get in any danger of mixing up whether we have to reduce with one handle or with the other. So without even considering the remaining input W, we can determine which of the what the actual handle is on a pushdown and perform a reduction. So that is an example for an LR0 grammar. So let's have a look at another example. There's a grammar with just two non-terminals. S goes to AAC and A goes to ABB or B. And once again, that is not an LLK grammar for any K, because in this case we see it quite directly. There's left recursion in the grammar, so this will never be able to be parsed with an LLK parser. But let's check what the K for an LRK grammar would be. So for that, we would once again need to set up all the right derivations possible with that grammar. So that would be the AC, for example. And with A, we could then do A B B C A A B B B B C and so on, which would then in the end be B to the 2n and C in the end. And yeah, finally there might be another B, so there's also another chain that would look like 2n plus 1 and C. And these are all the right derivations that we can do for that thing. So it seems that I have not done all of them, but only started with those two. But let's look at them. There, you see that although those two are starting pretty similar, so they have the same prefix, finally, this C and this B differentiate them with each other. So as we don't have any handle that already stops before we reach the symbol that differentiates between them, we can still uniquely determine the handle that is necessary to do these things. Well, I haven't done the rest of these things, but I think... Yeah, it is because I have left away all these W things on there, because I can already say without looking at the W which of the prefixes are actually handles of right-hand sides. So, yeah, I can determine that without looking at the W at all. So it diminishes to just those few sentence forms, and those I can distinguish from each other without looking into the input. So finally, let's try whether we can find an example for something that needs more than just LR0. So let's have a look at this one over here. So for this one, I will once again try to set up the sentence forms. I would have to proceed like the way that you have seen before. I would have to start with AAC. Then for A, I could choose either ABC or ABBAC and ABBBBAC ABB. B, 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 C, and so on. These would always occur in pairs, so I could say that these would generate B2N AC, and these would kind of generate A, BN plus 2N plus 1, and C like that. So these are the sentence forms that can be produced with the grammars from over there. And now it gets a little bit more interesting, because in these sentence forms we have to locate the handles for this
for these productions, and in and I would do that from the very left. So the first handle that I can find in this sentence form, for example, would be such a B. So I just highlight it and continue with the next of these forms. In this one, I would, for example, be able to locate this BBA as a possible handle. And now I have a situation where I have, if I match that with my form alpha, beta, gamma, I have to match AB with alpha. I have to match C with gamma, and B is the beta over here. I have to do the same thing for that form over here. I have A, B to 2n as match for alpha, and in this case C is matching it's not gamma, it's a Y, well, whatever. It's not so interesting here. Now I have actually a situation where my alpha beta in two of these sentence forms is actually a real prefix of the alpha beta in another sentence form. So here, if I would try to decide for stack contents that looks like A, B to the 2n, B, I need to decide whether I consider the following B as one that needs to be reduced to, well, in our case, an A, or whether I wait and try whether I can complete with small b and large A to the variant from here. And the way to decide it with an K grammar would be to try to look at the first K symbols from the remaining input and use that to try to differentiate from the other alternative that we have. And luckily, in our case, we see that the first symbol that we encounter after this C from the input is actually a C, which is quite different from the symbol that we find over here, which is a B. So turns out that by looking at just one look-ahead symbol in the input, I can already differentiate which of these situations I actually have. So it is not an LR0 grammar, but it is an LR1 grammar. I only need one symbol from the input to decide which of these how my handle actually has to look like. Okay. Last example looks like that. I make life a little bit more short, because we can just directly try to consider one particular rightmost derivation, which looks like that over here. That is something that could be rightmost derived from my S with certain steps. And here I would need to differentiate here whether to with this be, I think the question was that whether this B is considered to be a handle like this, or whether there could also be a handle that I can derive from that kind of form, and that would be A B to the N B A B B to the N C, and the question would now be how can I differentiate between the handle being this one, or the B being part of a handle that looks like that. For that, I would have to actually, if I look more to the right, I would only see that there's other Bs coming. So that would be what I can obtain from my input. However, this A thing itself has I can pump further instances of this right hand side in there, such that I get even more B's, so that I can in any case kind of exhaust any finite number of look ahead symbols that I take from my input with just the right sentence form there. So in that case, I can not decide whether this B is actually considered to be handled by itself, or whether it is has to be considered to be part of the composed right hand side. So for that case, I could not fix a constant K such that I could decide that. Thus, that is a grammar that is not LRK for any K.
Good. Since we are already at the end of that session, I would say let's continue on with this look-ahead construction next time. I think next week isn't there some kind of bank holiday or something?
Yeah, the 15th.
Yeah, so you've got plenty of time to reflect on that. Yeah, but we will continue on in 2 weeks' time, and I hope that you still remember anything from that, because it will continue right on from that. Anyway, have a nice bank holiday, and have fun in the tutorial afterwards, and see you again soon. Goodbye.